Good morning, everybody. It's not Friday, it's Thursday. It is March 28th, 2024, about 11:05 a.m. on the East Coast here in the United States. And I am Lisa Salberg, and you are listening to Tales from the Heart, a podcast from the Hypertrophic Cardiomyopathy Association. Today, I am joined by Dr. Alex DeFaria of UPenn, who comes to us every couple weeks or so to join us on the podcast. We meet with him on Thursdays, typically, not Fridays, because UHCM patients keep him really busy on Fridays. So good morning, Alex. How are you today?
I'm great. I have HCM clinic this afternoon, so Thursday mornings work out well for me.
So hopefully some of your patients will have tuned in already and gotten to have some extra time with you.
They have brought it up in clinic.
Oh, there you go. You're becoming infamous on the internet, let's say. So month of March, we've been talking a lot about arrhythmias and arrhythmia management, and we've had some really robust discussions with Dr. Matt Martinez, Dr. Harry Lever, Dr. Marty Marin, and we've really dug into the nuts and bolts on arrhythmias. And if you've missed any of those episodes, I encourage you to go back and listen. There was some great content. And of course, you know, Harry and I had to jump down the generic drug and PBM argument a little bit too. So there's some fireworks and fun stuff on that podcast. But today, Alex, I thought you and I could have a slightly different conversation about arrhythmias. And that is from the psychological impact of these devices and the threat of arrhythmias and what it's like to be a real family living with the risk of arrhythmia constantly, but doesn't really show up very often, but the risk is always there and the threat is always there. And how do patients manage the expectations, the concerns, the fears of their heart going out of rhythm? So first, let's define what rhythm is and what normal and abnormal is real briefly, and then we can start talking about how each might impact somebody a little bit differently.
Yeah. And so normally, we talk about a normal sinus rhythm when we're talking about what we call a normal heart rhythm. And that means that there's a little node, a little gatekeeper at the top of your heart that sends a message down to the top chambers, those atria, tells them to squeeze. And then it makes it down to the second gatekeeper, which then tells the bottom chambers, the ventricles, to squeeze. And so in a normal rhythm, you get the top squeeze and the bottom squeeze. And there's a lot of different kinds of abnormal heart rhythms that can happen. Some affect the top chambers, some affect the bottom chambers, some affect those gatekeepers. So sometimes you can have the top gatekeeper, the sinus node, stop working. That's very uncommon for HCM for that to happen. It can happen with age as you get older. So some of our older HCM patients in their 70s, 80s might run into that, but it's not common for a young HCM patient to have that. And then there's the other node, the middle node, that's called the AV node. That sometimes can stop working too. And then you get something called complete heart block, where the top chambers stop talking to the bottom chambers. And so then the bottom chambers say, well, hey, I'm not going to let you die, but I can't squeeze that fast. So they go about 30 to 40 beats a minute. And most people don't feel very well with that. Getting back to the arrhythmias or abnormal heart rhythms from the chambers, you can have abnormal heart rhythms from the top chambers. The one you hear the most about, the one that we look for a lot, is called atrial fibrillation, where the top chambers are, they essentially are very erratic. Electrically, they don't pay attention to that top node anymore. They just say, I'm going to squeeze as fast as I want, as irregular as I want, whenever I want. And that most HCM patients feel really bad in that. And we've talked about AFib in the past on this podcast, but most HCM patients do not tolerate that. And not only that, but it's a risk for having a clot form in your heart and a stroke. So we're always looking for those rhythms. And it has a cousin called atrial flutter, which essentially does the same thing. And then there's abnormal rhythms from the bottom chambers. And those are the ones that we talk about that are sudden death risk. And those are also ones we're looking for. So those are called ventricular tachycardias. And those, interestingly, you can't feel them most of the time unless if they are life-threatening. And that is the rhythm that we look for a lot of times to decide if someone needs a defibrillator. So that's kind of in a nutshell, all the rhythms we're thinking about that we're concerned for when we're evaluating you guys in clinic.
Let's break some of this down and I spent the last three podcasts on this topic talking very clinically about the physical, why this happens, what they are, what the rhythms are, what are risk factors. That's all in the other podcast. But today I want to talk about, starting with AFib, the psychological impact of atrial fibrillation in a family. My dad and my sister were both AFib patients. My father was cardioverted 13 or 14 times. This is early 2000s. My sister was always right at the edge of being cardioverted, but the drugs converted her. She would be hospitalized. And it was one of those moments where, like, everybody stopped in the family. So-and-so is back in the hospital. It's AFib again. It was even so bad that my, you know, because stress was my dad's trigger for AFib. Stress and chocolate, you know, your triggers.
Can't avoid either.
Well, there were times where I looked at my father and I went, you know what's going to happen. He's like, but I want the chocolate cake. And he had the chocolate cake. And then I'd say, look what happened. So, like, it became a family joke, a little odd humor, but it did. But there was a very stressful experience for our family. And it was the day my grandmother passed away, his mom. I had my father in one hospital being cardioverted, and across town, my grandmother was in the other hospital dying. You're just like, and here it is again. I'm trying to live a normal life. My grandmother was in her 80s and she was dying naturally and didn't have HCM, but it was so stressful for my dad that it sent him into AFib, and that was his trigger. You know, he was a stress trigger person. And psychologically, as a family member, you want to take care of them. It's scary. There's stroke risk. He's uncomfortable. He's nervous. His heart rate's elevated. We're nervous. We're watching it. Emotionally, atrial fibrillation is draining for everybody involved. How do we manage through these episodes?
Taking a step back, I would say HCM patients, the vast majority of patients do know exactly when they go into AFib. There are a handful that have no idea, but most know. And so the way that a lot of folks describe it to me is that I was doing fine, and all of a sudden it was like I was walking on, like running through sand. Like everything was harder. Everything would slow me down, and all of my symptoms that I have at my worst after eating a big meal or something and going up a flight of stairs, that's what I feel like all the time now. It's like I'm running a marathon. And that is, one, it's just a terrible quality of life. And two, it's anxiety provoking, especially if you know you have triggers. You know, what am I going to do? Like, how am I going to live this way if I can't do these things? Scared I'm always going to pop into AFib. I tend to be pretty aggressive with atrial fibrillation in terms of, if a patient of mine sends me a message saying, hey, I just popped into AFib, I usually try and get them in the hospital or in to see me in clinic quickly. And if it's the first time, then we'll do like with your dad. And a lot of times we will try cardioversion and changing meds. But I usually even have a conversation at that point about saying we should try and do something to prevent this from happening again. I'm at an institution that's very aggressive with what's called ablation, where we do procedures to try and burn away those rhythms to prevent them from coming back. And the reason we're aggressive with it is because we have a lot of really good electrophysiologists. But there's also medications to try. So a lot of times, I don't let folks just hang out in AFib because they feel bad. And the longer you're in AFib, the harder it is to get rid of. One way to deal with it is to try and prevent it from happening again. If there are triggers that you know, some folks, it's alcohol. Like anytime I have a sip of alcohol, boom, I go into AFib. And so a lot of it is trying prevention, whether it's something you can do or something I can do to prevent you from going back into AFib. But the goal is to keep you out of it.
After living in it a long time, and I haven't been there in a long time because my dad and my sister are both gone a while now, but we kind of developed a bit of a playbook as a family. When dad would go into AFib, he didn't like anybody going with him to the hospital. He liked to go alone, but that's not very safe. So my mother would let him drive himself because that's the way he did it. And then she would call me and say, he's there. And then I would come into the emergency room and he'd be in one of two bays because that's where they put him all the time. And I'd walk in and say, what'd you do now, asshole? And he would laugh at me. And then he would say, your damn mother. And I'm like, she didn't think she was going to call. This was the game that we played. And it gave him a little distraction. He could play mad at me for showing up. And I could show mad at him for being in, you know, stress and not letting the stress out better, or eating the chocolate cake at the graduation party or whatever. So we just kind of had this cadence that we would go back and forth with, but it was really, it was scary. It was unsettling, and it would take a couple of weeks for things to calm down again. And hopefully we could get a little AFib holiday in there. Eventually, his AFib led to him going into a reduced ejection fraction, heart failure. He needed a lot of surgery. His kidneys took a hit. And in the end, kidney disease is what actually killed my father. The HSAM was just an aggravator. But AFib was really hard on him. And psychologically, it was challenging to deal with for him. And my sister, Lori, when she was in AFib, she was in her early 30s. And she would pop into AFib all the time. And it was which management would work. And in her early 30s, they had put her on high-dose amiodarone, which then caused a whole bunch of other problems to happen. So AFib is serious. It's scary. We're doing better today at managing the risks. We have better blood thinners for clot risk, stroke reduction. We have better ablation techniques, more complete techniques. So I think it's, you know, from a psychological point of view, you're still going to that playbook. What can I do to make this better? What are all the tools that I can use to keep myself as safe as possible, even if I have to live in AFib? Yeah. What do I do to keep my rate down? What do I do to keep my anticoagulation optimized? And
speaking of like arrhythmias, and we're going to get into defibrillators, mm-hmm. you know, not having your AFib under control can unfortunately put you at risk for having inappropriate shocks from your device. And so that's a whole nother problem that we deal with too, trying to keep people out of AFib so they don't have to deal. Like, we think a lot about, oh my gosh, what if my device goes off? But we're thinking about it appropriately. Like, right. There's a whole different kind of anger and aggravation and fear if it goes off for reasons that aren't appropriate, like a fast heart rate that's from AFib and not from your ventricles.
So the HCM patient in Alex came out there a bit, and it's a word that I try not to use a lot, but I do feel, and it's anger. It's an anger, like, why the fuck is this happening again?
Yeah.
What is this? And for those of you who are listening, and I've dropped a few curse words today, Lisa is from New Jersey, and these are just part of speech, and they fall out sometimes. Deal with it. We're all grown-ups. It's words. It does make you angry. Arrhythmias make you angry because they take away your trust of your body. They take away a level of trust. That's the way I feel about it. I just went through this new experience. Well, it hasn't really been new. It's been going on a while. I had bradyarrhythmias. My heart was stopping. Oops, we got her fixed again. But it doesn't incite anger. It's like, what now? Why are you not working? You got one job. Let's just do it.
Beat. You don't even have HCM anymore, and you're still
Well, it's not just HCM that has rhythm problems.
Yeah, I know.
I just think my body likes technology and it wants the latest and the greatest.
No, it's a helpless feeling. Even not going as far as like a full-blown arrhythmia, but just palpitations and skip heartbeats is such, it's a thing I've struggled with in my life. My patients tell me about it all the time. And I know I've had days where I was like, I don't know if I can do procedures today. Like, it's every third beat I feel boom, boom. And I just feel wiped out. I've been there.
Let's stay in that moment for a second. At the end of my HCM heart, I was averaging some crazy number of PVCs a day, like 20, 30,000 a day. Like, I don't think I had normal heartbeats for more than 3 or 4 seconds at a clip before a PVC would pop in. That moment that you feel the thud, thud, thud. Is it, for me, it was this distraction. And frankly, I've been having this distraction since I'm like 12 or 13 years old. And you're not in the room anymore with the people and the things and the whatevers. You're in yourself. You're in your body. You're like, are you just going to be a little annoying today? Or are you going to go do something really, really bad? I can remember being in high school, listening to some, I think it was like a business ethics class that I took in high school. I just remember thinking that the topic was such nonsense compared to what I was living in the moment. I'm like, I'm not sure if my heart's going to beat again. I really don't give a shit about your corporate ethics policy or whatever they were teaching us about. But I wasn't there anymore in the room. I wasn't paying attention. I was in myself. I was in my body. I was wondering if I was crazy, who somebody, does it distract you?
Yeah, I mean, it makes it really hard to be in the moment ever. If you're having symptomatic skipped heartbeats, PVCs. It kind of feels like every couple beats, it's like a little bit of your soul is like, oof. And it really, what sound, and I think, you know, putting the doctor hat back on, it's very easy to dismiss it as a physician. So, okay, everyone has palpitations. But when, I don't know, and maybe especially if you have obstruction, you know, if you have a palpitation, if you have a PVC, you know, you skip one beat and that allows your heart to fill, but you pause for a while. And then the next beat is just compensating for the last one. And you have even more obstruction with that beat. And you just feel bad. And so, yeah, I didn't have it for many years. Then this last year, I don't know if it's work or a baby or what, but.
Work and a baby and life and HCM.
I've had a couple episodes where I'm just like, man, I feel bad today. And then, you know, you change dosage of meds, try and sleep, and then it can get better. But it is a big deal. It's a big deal that shouldn't be dismissed. And there's things that can be done about that too. So if the patients are listening out there and thinking, I guess this is what I keep trying to nail down with my patients, especially on the first visit. You've been living like this for so long that you think this is normal. And it's kind of retraining your brain to think, I can feel better than this.
There's a tipping point for me that I've seen. It's, they think it's normal, so it's not bothering them. Then when they find out that there's actually something structurally wrong with their heart and they feel it, now they're really worried about it and it's distracting and they feel every beat. Like the first 2 years after diagnosis, you feel everything, you overanalyze everything, you're in your head a lot. And that's where I think education and grounding and realistic expectations really come into play.
The monitors that I do every year for my patients, is part of it is for me, so I know that nothing dangerous is going on, but part of it is for you guys. Because when you hit that button, you say, I feel like shit right now. And I can look at that moment on February 24th at 3 p.m. and say, you know what? You did have skip beats there. And that's why you felt that way. And we can adjust your meds to try and calm that down. That is validating. Or it's also validating if there was nothing there and they're like, okay, I'm not having a heart attack, you know? And so part of it's for you guys too, just as much as it's helpful for me for clinical management.
So I remember, I told this story a couple days ago to somebody. I was sitting in my car and my daughter was in gymnastics, which I think we stopped when she was like 8. She's 28 now, so that gives you a timeline. I was listening to a conference call because we didn't have Zoom back then or whatever, right? And she was in gymnastics and I was in the car and I had left the auxiliary on so I could get heat. I had turned the engine off, but I didn't remember that I turned the engine off because as I was sitting in the car, I felt this rumbling. It was my chest. I was having a lot of palpitations. Yeah. I thought the car was running. So when my daughter got back in the car after gymnastics and I went to turn the car on and leave, like the car was not on already. And I'm like trying to put it in gear and go back. I'm like, car's off. That's my body moving. Because I was having so many PVCs and it just was so noisy. And I talked to my doctor and my doctor said at that time, let's try you on a calcium channel blocker on top of your beta blocker. And that was all I needed to smooth out those arrhythmias for many years. And I didn't feel them anymore. And it made me more comfortable. I was less distracted. It's about noticing, communicating, and looking for what solutions might be available for you. Let's move into the other part of arrhythmias, the bottom chamber arrhythmias, the ventricular tachycardias that can get out of hand and potentially turn into the Mac Daddy, what we try to avoid with everything in our being, and that's ventricular fibrillation. So we know, and you can go back to the other podcasts and you can learn all the risk factors. We won't spend a lot of time on that today. Let's talk about the technology of devices and how they've evolved.
Yeah.
I had a transvenous dual chamber pacer defib and I got my first one in 97. I was 27 years old or so, maybe 28 years old when I got it. But now there's SICDs and newer ones. So why don't you talk a little bit about what's going on now?
So I got my first device down at Emory when I was 21. So that would have been 15 years ago. And at that time, the only thing you could really get was a transvenous device. And when I say that, you have a can, which is just the actual bulk of the device. It's literally a can with a lot of technology in it, but essentially a capacitor that can generate a high energy to shock and pace. So all defibrillators can pace. Pacemakers cannot defibrillate. That's a common thing that we go through. So the ICD used to have that with wires that go through the veins in your arm down into the right side of your heart. And you can either have one wire, you can have two wires, or you can have three wires, depending on what your clinical situation is. A couple years after that, they started making subcutaneous ICDs, devices that can sit under the left side of your chest, essentially like under your arm. If your arm is right down, it sits somewhere back in there. Those devices are bigger than the traditional ICDs. So the can sits here and it can be larger. And the wires actually run subcutaneously. So under the skin, outside of the body, outside of the rib cage, and they run in here. Those devices can defibrillate, but they cannot pace. You can imagine if you tried to pace somebody with that, you'd be trying to shoot electricity through their skin, muscle, bone to the heart, every beat to pace them, which would be painful. So we do not pace with that. And most of our HCM patients don't need pacemakers, and they really need the defibrillator. And so that was an attractive option, because if you can avoid putting wires in the blood vessels, then you know you will avoid the risk of having complications, like complications in the blood vessels that the wires are running in. God forbid if you were to ever have a bloodstream infection. I actually had a bloodstream infection the year before I got a device. I applied to medical school from a hospital bed at Emory with staph infection. And so I got lucky that I had been a stupid young man and refused to get a device, or else I probably would have had it removed. So in that sense, ignorance is bliss. That's a complication of having an intravascular device, is that if you ever had a bacteria in your bloodstream, it could latch onto that device and then you have to remove the device. So that is a benefit of having a subcutaneous device. The downsides of the subcutaneous device is you can't pace. And then for some of my patients, especially the apical hypertrophic cardiomyopathy patients, that their EKGs show that funky T wave, those devices don't sense very well and they can get confused. And so a lot of times they don't work well for certain HCM patients. So keep that in mind when you go see your cardiologist and say, oh, you should just get a subcutaneous device. You will need to be fitted, make sure it's appropriate for you before you get that. And now there's a newer device. It was just FDA approved in the last couple months. It's only being implanted at certain centers across the world, of which I think we have three of like the 50 electrophysiologists in the world implanting them are here at Penn. And so we've done quite a few of them now. But it's an extravascular ICD, or EV ICD. And that is trying to thread the needle between having a subcutaneous device where nothing's in the blood vessels, but then having the advantage of having the same kind of device that you have with a transvenous ICD. The benefits are that you can pace, defibrillate, and the battery life is longer. The battery life on these traditional devices, so I got my device replaced 13 years after I got the first one put in. But I didn't use it.
Somebody better knock on wood or throw salt or some other superstition real quick.
I bring this up every one of the rooms, so it's not, you know, it was an insurance policy for me, and that's what it is for a lot of people. And so my battery lasted for a long time and I got it just replaced 2 years ago. The subcutaneous devices, those batteries do not last nearly as long. And so we're still learning with these new devices, but I think that having an extravascular ICD, if they pan out to be as good as they sound like they are, that could be a really good option for our patients that are going to have devices for the rest of their lives to try and avoid some of the complications.
The good news is, within the HCM community, inappropriate shocks are way down. We've gotten really good at programming and assessing, putting settings that aren't too aggressive. So how the device is managed, what ultimate heart rate will it let you go to. We don't get as many inappropriate shocks. They do happen, but they're incredibly rare today. I'd say 20 years ago, it was something that we really needed to talk about because it was happening a bit. And it still wasn't common, but it was still happening. And it doesn't happen that often today. If you have a new device going in and one of our community members is getting a device today, just so happens. The minute you get it put in, you are 100% convinced that it's going off next week. Like, it's going to do its thing. Then the week goes by and it doesn't do it, and 2 weeks go by and it doesn't do it, and 3 weeks go by, and literally maybe it's out of the blue somewhere it happens, or it happens in your sleep and you don't even know it, and it goes off and saves your life. The first time my ICD ever shocked me was the day after I got home from my transplant, and it was in my hand and the wires were still on, and I shocked myself. That was the only time it shocked me. It is on our Facebook channel. It was live in front of a whole bunch of you. Oh
my gosh.
My poor husband, because I scream and he comes around. He's like, now what did you do? I just got home with a transplant. And I'm like shocking myself. So yeah, that was the first time my ICD ever went off. And I had like every risk factor known, like family history, massive hypertrophy, end stage presentation, NSVT captured multiple times. And even with all those risk factors, it was just my safety net all the time. I had a really great relationship with my implantable devices. They were my friends. They were my 24/7 emergency room. And they go off very infrequently. But that threat / protection of the possibility comes in at the worst times. Or it did for me.
Yeah.
It did for me. Like I wouldn't think about it. And then all of a sudden you're like, why am I thinking about it? Why did I just start thinking about my device? Why did I just start thinking about this? Yeah. And you're like, oh, something must happen. And then nothing happens. And then you diffuse your anxiety again. Like it's a roller coaster.
It can be an unpredictable disease and a humbling disease in the sense that some people can only have one risk factor, you know, and then they can have an event. And then other people can have everything.
They never.
And not, which makes it challenging when we're deciding who gets these. Because there are guidelines, but a lot of times people fall in like a gray zone about who should get it and what they shouldn't. And if you look at certain data, it looks like we put in a lot more defibrillators than our colleagues in Europe do, yet have similar mortality outcomes. I think it's way more complicated than just that paper, but even the decision to get a defibrillator is a huge thing. And I recently have sent multiple young people to get them, and it's a big discussion.
Let's talk a little bit. There's the clinical discussion. We've spent 3 hours of podcasting talking about the statistics and the rationale and the risk factors. But when all of that is pushed aside, and let's say you agree that there's risk as a patient and you agree that you want to be protected, then there's this emotional side. Like, what am I signing up for? What's this going to cost me? And cost isn't dollars and cents. It's mental time. Yeah. It's thought energy, it's stress energy. There's a lot of different ways to measure cost rather than dollars and cents. But there are the dollars and cents. It's got to be replaced. It's got to be managed. It's got to become part of your budget. And then there's the psychological price, which can be positive and negative. How do you as a clinician with a device help people through that mental challenge of protection versus risk with a device?
I think one part of it is, and this is the patient, I think, in me speaking to this, what people don't realize and don't think about is that sometimes the ICD is the first thing that exposes you as someone with a disease. Other people with other diseases, it's very obvious that they suffer from it. Most of us with HCM, you have no idea these people have HCM unless you notice they're struggling to get up the flight of stairs or something like that. For a lot of people, this is the first thing. This is the first scar you're going to get. And so this is the first time you're going to get padded, have to walk around the metal detector. And everyone's like, well, why are you doing that? I got mine. The millimeter wave detectors in the airport were not there. So it was always getting padded down and always, you know, you're getting singled out. And so there is an emotional, psychological aspect of this that for a lot of us, you can hide this. And that's the first step to not being able to hide anymore. And that's tough.
I had a dad, a young dad. He's a little bit older of a dad now. And he wanted to get the device, but he didn't want his sons to know he had a device. He didn't think that they were old enough to process this. And he didn't want to burden them with the thought. So he had to strategically figure out how to not be without a shirt in front of his kids because he didn't want to worry them. And I'm like, sweetheart, just talk normal, like just normalize it. Don't hide it. Normalize it. This is just to protect daddy's heart. We're fine. Like, this is, that's what it's for. Discussing a device while dating, discussing a device during intimacy. These are complicated conversations. We have reports on that topic. And the answer is yes. If one person's shocked, the other one can feel it. There, I said it. It's been out there. I know a number of people who've done it, but there's a lot of emotions that go along with that kind of a situation as well. You have to talk about it.
Yeah. So acknowledging that is important, apart from like all the numbers. And I mean, that's great. But to be honest, my discussion about that, all that stuff went like, I didn't hear, this is your risk over 5 years, blah, blah, blah. It was like, how is this going to impact my day to day? It deserves an informed conversation about that. This is probably, if you're 22, you're going to have, hopefully, multiple of these throughout your life, unless the battery technology improves such that we can space it out. Understanding that you're going to need to have these replaced and the risks of having them. And then, you know, we do have this risk calculator that I'm sure you talked about in the past. I use that as more of a discussion point than something to make the decision, because you put in all your risk factors and it says, this is the likelihood you might have something happen to you in 5 years. Some people need that. Some people respond to granular data. If you say you've got a 6% chance of having a life-threatening heart rhythm in the next 5 years, one person may say, oh, great. Well, I have a 94% chance nothing's going to happen. See ya. And then the other person will say, that's way too much. I also think it's important, we shouldn't be telling you what to do. You know, we should be giving you the guidance and helping you make the right decision for you and your family. I think it's laying down as much available information as we can so that you can make the right decision for yourself, I think is the goal of the conversation. But you don't want to shortchange people by telling them, oh, you just get it, you'll be fine. Because most of the time, people are just fine. And most of the time, people will come back 6 months later and tell me, I don't even think about the fact that I have a device anymore. But not everybody is like that. Some people will have complications. Some people will feel this device. Some people will say, I don't want this anymore, and take it out. And I think you have to acknowledge that. And it's not fair for, I mean, I've been fortunate, I haven't had a problem with mine, but I do have patients that do. And they had problems when they got it implanted.
I have problems today because of my device. I love my device. We got along great. But my journey with devices was 92, my first pacemaker, 97, my first dual chamber pacer defib. That had to be put in subpectorally because the unit was so big, it would have, and it did even rip through my skin going through the pectoral muscle. I started to degrade the skin. And then the device changed because it failed. It was a manufacturer defect in the connection between the computer board and the energy device. So the solder broke because the table wasn't to temperature. And humans made these devices and they learned and they changed manufacturing processes. I do have to give a nod to somebody that I met, and I have his autograph on my wall because I'm this kind of a geek. There's a gentleman by the name of Wilson Greatbatch. I will guarantee 98% of you have never even heard that name before. Wilson Greatbatch was actually given, he's a recipient of the National Medal of Technology and Innovation, and it was presented by George H.W. Bush in 1996. And he is the man who created the battery technology that became small enough to put into the body. He has 325 patents. I met him at a Heart Rhythm Society meeting in like 2000. I think he died in 2011. So he had his medal on him. He was very proud. And I had a device and I went up to him and said, on behalf of patients everywhere, thank you for allowing us to leave the hospital and not be attached to a machine and get out and live our life. And he was so sweet and so kind. That's around the time that I met him. I got a replacement in 2001, a replacement in 2004 because the battery depleted too quickly. Then 2011, and that device took me to the end. And now I have a leadless pacemaker because I have heart block. Technology has advanced so much in that time, and we have so much more functionality. It's amazing. And the technology is awesome. And I'm really happy that we have it. But not everybody needs it. It's not without risk. And I do think even in 2024, low volume HCM programs pull the punch too quick to tell people to device up. and the risk of arrhythmias hasn't really been assessed by a specialty team. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the psychological benefits to hearing from an expert in your disease before you decide to get a device.
The benefits of talking both to the cardiologist, who's the general person that's taking care of everything, and doing the initial assessment about the device, and an electrophysiologist that is trained and takes care of people with HCM, are, you know, multifold. One, let's just stick with just an electrophysiologist for a second. And you mentioned earlier that you can program devices appropriately so that you don't have issues. So there are many, many patients with HCM that are very active people, as they should be. I would love for everyone with HCM to be active if they can physically do it. And so for those people, you might have to be thinking about adjusting their devices in such a way so that they're not going to get shocked when their heart rate gets up to 180 because they're 20 and they're running. You don't want someone that doesn't deal with that to then do settings that would potentially be harmful to people. So there's that aspect, and the aspects of like which devices are better for certain patients with HCM. There's a lot of nuance to this. But then even seeing a specialist and kind of going through the whole algorithm, there's nuance even to like, you know, one of the big things we think about is, have you ever passed out in your life? You really want to talk to somebody that's really paying attention to the circumstances around your, what we call syncope. Because if it's, when I give blood, I pass out every time. There's certain kinds of events that can lead anybody to pass out that are not necessarily HCM related. And you definitely don't want to be putting in devices for people that, you don't want to be so sensitive that you're putting in devices for people that probably shouldn't be getting them. You don't want to be putting in devices for people that want to play sports but feel safe because they have a device. And even then, some people that probably don't need a device get a device, and then they can't play sports because they don't want to play sports on the device. So there's so much that goes into this. And so a lot of the centers that, you know, you've helped build have expertise in all of these things. I mean, in our center, we have someone that literally is the person that did the studies that showed it's safe to exercise. And, you know, Dr. Day is, you know, a giant in this field, and she helps people figure out their high intensity athletes that have HCM what to do with their devices. So there's a lot of benefits to going to places where you see this a lot.
It's interesting that you bring that up as the example. I became aware of a case over the summer where Northeast, heat of the summer, somebody passes out, ends up in an emergency room with a new diagnosis of HCM, and within 3 days they have an implantable defibrillator because they passed out. Turns out that they had a gradient of 140. So, like, people, take a breath. And I'm gonna let you behind the veil for a second on my plots and plans for the future. So for those of you who've known me a little while, I had this crazy idea back in like 1996 when the internet was kind of like new, to put information into a democratized format on the website, a website, so that patients could become more knowledgeable about their HCM. We've grown so much that maybe we can help with more specific tools to help people assess their own risk and understand what life can be like, might be like, and could be like based on different decisions that they make along the way. Do not think something's coming next week on something like this, but these are conversations that we're having now as a more global community. How do we get everybody on the same page? The payers, meaning your insurance company or the government, paying systems like Medicare, Medicaid, the clinicians, like Dr. Teferia, not Alex, the patient, but Dr. Teferia, what he's dealing with in HCM, and then the patient point of view. And how do we all start talking in the same language and understand each other's goals and objectives? I think there are some new tools that we can create that will help people make those decisions in the construct of their social well-being. What is best for you? What is best for me? They're different things.
Well, and even I think HCM has been shortchanged in a lot of ways, because even within cardiology, we try and reappropriate things from heart failure and apply them to HCM, and they don't work. You know, I stood up on my soapbox and talked about how a lot of, you know, the things we use to judge patient symptoms, even in the trials, that the things that we're taking as gospel is like, if you have an improvement in this score, then you must be doing better. I know my patients, like, and they don't have a lot of the symptoms that other patients have. They have very different symptoms. And that's why a lot of us see three or four people before anybody figures out what's going on, because you're not asking the right questions. And so I think the tools you're making are important, because not only, I mean, they actually might give a voice to the patients too, so they can realize, oh yeah, I always feel terrible after eating a big meal. No one's ever asked me that. So I do think that the personalized tools, whether it's for risk or whether for symptom management, could empower patients a little bit.
We will be running some focus groups very soon on topics in this space. And we are going to be getting lots of stakeholders to the table over the next 2 years to have some really important conversations about where we are going and how to get there with shared language and shared objectives. And managing arrhythmias is a critical part of managing life with HCM, even if it's strictly the risk of the arrhythmia, or the experience of having the arrhythmia, or the experience of being a family member with another family member experiencing an arrhythmia. My daughter's had a device since she's 10 years old. I lost a lot of sleep making that decision for a 10-year-old child. Her device has gone off inappropriately once, questionably another time, and she was this close a couple of weeks ago to her device going off, plus somebody broke into her car while she was walking down the street and she watched him. So my daughter, Jersey girl, decides I'm going to run after the bad guy with a defibrillator and HCM. And he took her prescription medication out of her car, which were beta blockers. I think
good
he's
luck with that propofol, buddy.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to have the impact that he wishes it would. He's going to have a nice sleep. So he took her medication and a little bit of cash and ran down the street, and she ran after him. And then she gets a call from the defibrillator clinic. What were you doing at this time on this day? Because your heart rate was like within a few beats of going, your heart defibrillator going off. So, and then she tells me this, and I'm like, okay, so this is just like a life moment. Like, being a parent is difficult. Being a human in the United States in 2024 is difficult. Being a woman human in the United States in 2024 is uniquely difficult in ways it wasn't before. So like all the difficulties of existing, and then your kid calls and you find out her defibrillator almost went off because somebody stole something out of her car and she ran after him.
Yeah.
You just take a deep breath and go, life is complicated. And you pivot and you roll and you find the humor and you learn and you share and you commiserate and you move on. Don't run after the guy who steals shit out of your car. Just let him go. Let him go. Take a picture. Use your phone. Get a video. Follow him where he's going in your car, safe or whatever, but don't run after him.
Yeah.
My daughter thinks because she can control thoroughbred horses, she can, you know, run after bad guys in the street who are stealing from her. Don't do that. Dr. DeFaria, advice for patients psychologically adjusting to managing arrhythmias, the role of psychotherapy.
Yeah.
When do we bring in more help?
I think that as a whole, we do a very bad job at this.
Yeah.
When I was a medical student, I started an ICD support group for younger people because the ICD support group they had was like, everyone was like 80. You can have the same amount of psychological trauma if you're getting a device when you're 75 as you can when you're 18. So not to dismiss that, but it is a different experience. It is a different life experience. If you're a young person that's ever had a myectomy and you're the only person on the floor walking laps that's not over 60, that's a very different experience too. We tried to start something for younger people to talk about the challenges. I don't know if that ever took off because I left Vanderbilt after med school. And it's something that we haven't done here at Penn. And that's probably, and it's something I applauded the Marins for, because when I saw that their clinic was opening up, I saw that that was one of the things that they offer. I haven't had a chance to talk to Marty about how that's worked out since, but I think every clinic should have a resource to get people plugged in.
We offer the discussion group on life with devices. I'll be speaking it shortly myself. We have a great volunteer running that project for us. We probably need to do more. We need to do more about technology. We need to turn these discussion groups into some training and some resource development as well. We've got the framework. We just need to build it out more. And then each institution needs to commit some resources here. And I say this with all due respect to the people who built what I'm about to compare us to. The cancer care model is so different than the cardiac care model. And to a cancer, there is a beginning, a middle, and an end, and God willing, a remission and a long life after. You know, the worry doesn't ever completely go away. We understand the lifetime of what if and again and surveillance. But we take care of the whole patient when it comes to cancer. We provide them nutrition, biofeedback, music therapy, pet therapy, lots of ways of coping. We don't do that so well in cardiology. And we need to do better, because a pat on the back and a see you in 6 months or see you in 2 years or see you in five, depending upon where you are in screening and whatever, it's not enough. No. It's not enough. And we hope to fill some of those gaps to ensure that patients feel fully supported through their entire life experience with HCM, deciding to have children, deciding not to have children, deciding how to have children.
Yeah.
Adoption, surrogacy, naturally, PGD.
Yeah.
All of these options are out there. The risk of arrhythmia to a mother giving birth, the risk of a father getting excited. And, you know, there's all of this life stuff that goes on while we have HCM. We got to be better at managing the whole thing.
Many of the times, it's multiple people in your family, it's not just you. So then understanding the parent grief and the sibling grief and the son or daughter grief, the grandparent grief, where then you see multiple generations of people below you with it. Support groups are helpful, not for everybody. Some people need one-on-one. That's something that I was thinking about this week, about trying to, because I had a patient that could be transitioning towards end stage HCM, which is rare. And a lot of stuff going on. And I had to have a very serious conversation with them. And it was our first meeting, you know? Oh. And so that's a big talk.
It's a huge talk. So we keep looking for ways that we can support your clinical work with resources. And we added in a pre-transplant discussion group the first Monday of every month. And those are for people who heard the word for the first time and are being told to investigate that line. And we have some people who've been through the entire disease process through transplant that are there to help guide and deal with the emotional unpacking of what does this actually mean? And the unreality of the reality that, wait a minute, you want to do what? You want to get rid of what part of my body and give me another one? It's daunting. It's frightening. It's awesome. It's powerful. And it's not without risk. We need to help get them through. And much like somebody who doesn't have a lot of symptoms with HCM, but has a high risk factor for sudden death, and they don't feel sick, but they have risk. Coming to terms with treating that risk that they don't feel is very difficult. It's very, very difficult because I feel fine. But I say this, and I will use this kind of as a wrap up for this month and this conversation. Of all of the people that I've spoken to in 28, almost 30 years of this, right? Of all of them, the ones who I spoke to who had risk factors and didn't appreciate them because they didn't feel bad and aren't here anymore to talk to us, you don't get a second chance to make some decisions. And that's daunting, just that risk. And I am reminded of a really amazing person. He was a soccer player in the UK, and he had decided to retire because of his HCM diagnosis. And he came to the United States to speak at our meeting. And we talked, and he had a really thick heart. He had at least two risk factors for sudden death. And we joked with him, like, dude, there's a hospital up the street. There's a bar. They got some Absolut. We'll just put you right here on the bar, wipe you down with some alcohol. We'll go grab a device. We'll put it in right here. And I was half kidding and half not. That was June. The following December, the news broke that he had died and he had had a cardiac arrest on the field. And he had told me, I will get the ICD after my daughter is born. His daughter was born a week after he died. And there's a cautionary tale. If you have risk factors, take them seriously. You don't always get a chance to make a second decision here. He did not survive his out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. There were risk factors. He had a plan. Man plans, God laughs. And we lost a very, very fine young man. And I still wonder what would have been. What would have been? Emotionally, it's hard. Technically, it's hard. But the technology is pretty freaking awesome.
No better time to have HCM.
Good time to have bad disease that we can now make behave better. Alex, my dear, thank you so much for joining us on this edition of Tales from the Heart podcast from the Hypertrophic Cardiomyopathy Association. A big shout out to all of our sponsors. You can see them all at 4hcm.org. Special shout out to our friends at Cytokinetics and Bristol-Myers Squibb, who have doubled down and again, re-upped for their 24 sponsorship, and Tenaya Therapeutics as well. We have some new sponsors coming on board. And in fact, I have to get out of here and go to a meeting with a new friend. Lots of really interesting things happening in HCM, everybody, and I can't wait to share some new things as they become available. For those of you who will be in the Cincinnati area on May 4th, we are coming with a Big Hearted Warrior Tour meeting. You can register now online. We hope you're in the Cincinnati area and you want to come see us. Our good friends at Christ Hospital and Cincinnati Children's will be joining us. And we hope to have a couple of in-person events later this year as well. October at the Summit, HCM Summit. We will have Saturday night at the summit for all of the participants at the summit, which is a professional education meeting. And then Sunday, we'll turn it into the HCMA annual meeting. And we hope to see you all there. Lots of exciting things happening. Can't wait to share it all with you. I did drop a link over here on Wilson Great Batch because I like to geek out over famous friends and inventors that I've met over the years. And I think he was just a fascinating human being. And I hope you find his story as enjoyable as I did. Thank you all. Thank you, Alex.